And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This is an all-purpose edition of the Wild Side News. It's an action-packed update covering everything from the wars between butterflies and off-roaders to the raiders of the whale refuge in the Arctic waters south of Australia to the snow-laden trails that await your footsteps as we cover the globe to bring you the most significant stories making the news this week in the realms of nature. It's all coming up when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What a difference a year makes. I've been updating the archives, and I've got some great news about that, which I'll tell you a little later. But it was just about a year ago that I was reporting on the aftermath of the tsunami, and wondered aloud if 2005 was going to be the year of the weather story. Well, it certainly was that. And 2006 may continue to bring us drama from the weather fronts. Already, the storms that have battered Northern California may be setting the stage for yet another difficult change in the weather. But if I had to make a prediction about where the most dramatic stories about nature and the environment will occur in 2006, the story of what's happening as we speak down in the Arctic Ocean may sound the clarion call about the year ahead. We'll be talking with Paul Watson, captain of the Farley Mowat, who is using his boat to literally chase away various Japanese whaling ships which have been whaling in the Arctic whale refuge south of Australia. We'll get to the breaking story via satellite phone from him following the news in this first segment. Then in segment two, winter is a time when heading off onto the snow-laden trails can bring some very special rewards. We talk with Seth Levy of American Hiking Society about how to prepare for and enjoy this special winter sport. And then, in our third segment, we hear from Karen Schombach, who is trying to get the federal government to carry out its obligations to protect endangered species. In this case, it's the story of the Sand Mountain Blue Butterfly, which is being run over, literally, by people on off-road vehicles. We learn from this story where protective powers are headed. It's a future you need to be aware of. So, there's something for everyone, which we will get right into following this week's Nature News. So now, the news. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service initiated a public debate on Monday over its plan to lift federal protections from grizzly bears in the Yellowstone National Park area, a measure that would open the hunting of bears in surrounding western states. The number of grizzlies has grown in the last 30 years from 136 to more than 600, which now have spread into the land surrounding the Great Yellowstone Park. The presence of the large bears, which are a main attraction in the national park, is considered a nuisance to some in the outlying communities, and the claim that the bears' attraction to livestock raises the customary complaint that they are interfering with ranchers' livelihoods. Opposing the proposed hunting seasons are the regular defenders, such as the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Sierra Club. The stories of the success of wildlife management over the years, are now turning into the nightmare of witnessing the shooting of the animals so many have worked so hard to keep from vanishing. It is a story to be retold thousands of times in the years ahead. Look at a similar story with a different ending. Wildlife officials at the Yellowstone National Park have expressed concerns that the deaths of the majority of gray wolf pups might be due to a dog disease. Only about 22 wolf pups survived out of the 69 that were born in the park in 2005, said Doug Smith, who heads Yellowstone's Wolf Project. Last year's figures of the pups' survival are a record low in the 11-year history of the wolf's reintroduction to the park. The deaths are suspected to be due to the parvovirus, which leads to severe diarrhea and dehydration in the infected animal. While adults can withstand these stresses, young pups generally cannot. In the Yellowstone Park's northern region, as many as 41 pups out of the 49 born succumbed to the disease last spring, while the Leopold pack showed only 2 pups surviving from the 19 born. Strategies to counter these effects are being proposed, but vaccinations to prevent parvovirus would require 2 injections of every wolf. The likelihood of success in such an undertaking is questionable. Zoos across America are debating whether elephants are really capable of healthy captivity on a long-term basis. Such has caused the Pittsburgh Zoo to purchase a former hunting ranch to house a new conservation center to breed African elephants. The 700-acre center could later include cheetahs, black rhinoceros, and grebby zebras, but the biggest portion of the former Glen Savage Ranch would be dedicated to the pachyderms. Problems with caring for pachyderms have led 5 zoos, including those in Chicago, San Francisco, and Detroit, to discontinue their elephant exhibits. About 40 other zoos are expanding their exhibits to meet the standards set out by the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. You might want to grab a quick peek at your local pachyderm before they get packed up and transported to Pittsburgh. A federal judge who struck down a Bush administration decision to ease logging restrictions last summer issued an injunction Monday blocking as many as 144 timber sales in 3 states. The timber sales in Washington, Oregon, and California had been approved under the administration's decision to stop requiring that the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management look for and protect rare plants and animals before logging on the 505 million acres covered by the 1994 Northwest Forest Plan. Judge Marsha Peckman, in her decision Monday, wrote that the potential harm to the approximately 300 species protected by the old rule outweighed the potential harm to the government. Total income to the government from the sales was projected to be $2.7 million. The courts have again had to force the Forest Service to use science rather than politics and favoritism to preserve our last remaining old-growth forests, said Pete Frost, attorney for the Western Environmental Law Center in Eugene, Oregon. No acreage figure was immediately available, but the 144 timber sales totaled 289 million board feet, more than half the amount logged under the Northwest Forest Plan in 2004. And that's the news. And now, a few reminders. The most important news is that the Wildside News archives are essentially updated, which means that for those of you who have visited the archives to find a notice that this file cannot be found, will instead be once again listening to your Voices of the Earth. Please, if you find errors, let us know by sending an email to wildsidenews@cox.net. Thanks for your patience. Nature is making news every day, from the threats of global warming and the wreckage of weather to the breakthroughs in animal communication to what many are now referring to as the beginning of the next mass extinction. The passions to protect life on planet Earth are rising, and with such, the commitments to take increasingly direct action to protect the defenseless. This past week witnessed what may become the nature of nature news in the new year. It's the story of new resistance to the wanton taking of the animals. Some would call it greed, and many will say, it's killing the planet. As the passions rise, so too the battle lines. In the Arctic seas south of Australia, large boats are beginning to smash into one another over the issue of the future of whales on planet Earth. And now joining us from the Arctic Ocean is the captain of the Farley Moat, which is a vessel that travels the world working to really stand in defense and a guardian for the wild creatures and nature itself. Paul Watson, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Oh, thank you.
There are big stories happening, and you're right in the middle of it. Give us a heads up on what's happening down there.
Well, right now we're at the very bottom of the Indian Ocean, right in the middle, halfway between Perth and Cape Town, and we're pursuing the Japanese whaling fleet. They're running to the west, and they've been running since Sunday. We've caught up with them three times since December 21st. Every time we catch up with them, they begin to run. We don't have their speed, so all we can do is this hit-and-run type of tactic. But that's been successful in keeping them from killing whales for about a total of 15 days in the last month.
Explain why it is that you are where you are.
This is the Antarctic Whale Sanctuary in Japan, in violation of the International Whaling Commission regulations by whaling here. They're also in violation of the global moratorium on commercial whaling because this is a commercial whale hunt. They're also targeting fin whales, which are an endangered species protected by the CITES, or Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species. And they're taking whales in the Antarctic, Antarctic Australian Territory, which is a violation of Australian law. In addition, they just refueled from the Oriental Bluebird, their supply boat, inside the Antarctic Treaty Area, which is another violation. So what we have is these Japanese whalers are in violation of numerous international laws and regulations. And that's why we're down here, to intervene against their illegal activities.
Paul, you take direct action. You're not prepared to stand by and allow these things to happen. Certainly, there in other arenas, for other causes, people take action, and that is something that you are prepared to do. And in many respects, you're putting, well, there's a danger to what you're doing. For example, there was an event on Sunday, and apparently you're prepared to continue to take a stand in defense of the whales.
Well, our position is that the Japanese whaling vessels, the seven vessels that are down here, are operating in violation of international conservation law, and we have to stop them. And if that means disabling them or damaging their equipment, then we're prepared to do that. People seem to forget that these are criminals. They're not just ordinary people out here trying to make a living. They're no different than drug dealers or bank robbers. And so that's why we're taking the action that we're doing. It doesn't do any good to just take their picture and stand around and hold up protest signs. I mean, Greenpeace is trying to do their best, and they're limited by their, the tactics that they're allowed to do. And I'm glad they're down here. But we need to be more aggressive if we're going to actually put an end to this.
The Japanese claim that what they're doing is part of their research. They suggest that the process of taking these whales is something that they do in order to study and really advance the science of whales and cetaceans. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, it's totally bogus. That argument isn't even accepted by the Scientific Committee of the International Whaling Commission. This research whaling ends up in sushi bars all over Japan. Last year they made $250 million. They've now doubled their quota. They'll make close to $500 million, and they want to take even more next year. This is a commercial enterprise, and they're not fooling anybody by saying it's research. And they haven't even got permission to do this research from the International Whaling Commission. And you don't kill whales in a whale sanctuary as part of research. Also, they're in violation of rules that they're not allowed to take fin whales at any time, any place, for research or for any other reason. So this is a bogus argument. We don't buy it, and nobody else does either.
Now, you've had direct confrontations with the...
The Nishin Maru is the factory vessel for the Japanese Whaling Fleet.
Correct. And on Sunday, you actually had what the people are referring to as a sideswiping incident. How did that come about? How did you make that decision to take that action?
Well, on Sunday, we saw the Nishin Maru transloading whale meat to the Oriental Bluebird. And as we approached, the Nishin Maru threw off its lines and disengaged itself from the Oriental Bluebird and backed up. And as it did so, it collided with the Greenpeace ship, the Arctic Sunrise, and then sped off, and we were in pursuit. We tried to follow the propellers of the Nishin Maru by sending Zodiacs ahead and putting lines in front of them. But they were able to get away and started running. The next morning, we intercepted the Oriental Bluebird, the supply vessel. I ordered them out of the whale sanctuary. They refused to answer me, so I sideswiped them to get their attention and then ordered them out again, and they began to run.
Now, how do you communicate? Is this by bullhorn or is it by radio phone?
We communicate through the VHF radio, but there's not been much communication. The Japanese don't answer.
There's really quite a bit of action. As you mentioned, the Greenpeace vessels now have actually been, there's a dispute as to what the story is, but certainly Greenpeace is suggesting that the Nishin Maru literally set out to collide with them. It wasn't a totally serious impact. Front end of the Arctic Sunrise was damaged. Did you actually witness that incident?
Yeah, we witnessed the entire incident, and, Greenpeace is saying that the Nishin Maru rammed them, and the Japanese are saying Greenpeace rammed them. What actually happened is when the Nishin Maru disengaged from the Oriental Bluebird, to get away from us, they backed up and hit the Arctic Sunrise. They collided with the Arctic Sunrise, and I think that was negligence on the part of the captain of the Nishan Maru, but I don't think they deliberately rammed it.
Well, how are things proceeding today? Every day seems to be a new adventure. For example, there has been discussion that the Japanese may intervene militarily. What are you hearing about that?
Well, there's some talk about sending the so-called airborne police down after us. I don't know what they're going to do, take our fishers or strafe us, but it seems a little useless to send airplanes down here. They're not going to be able to land. So I don't know exactly what they're going to do, but Japan can do whatever they want. But the fact is that this is an illegal operation, and we're not going to retreat off because of Japanese bullying. You know, if these were Indonesian or fishing vessels, Australia would be all over them, and rightfully so. But because Japan's a wealthy nation, the message that Australia is sending is, you do what you want. We're not going to interfere with you. The fact is they're in violation of Australian law by killing whales in the Australian Antarctic territory. And the Australian law would intercept. For instance, they go after Patagonia tooth fishermen down here who are fishing, and they're no different than the Japanese whalers.
The Australians have suggested they may send out vessels to witness what's going on, as well as the New Zealand, I believe, has done the same. Have you seen any action from them?
Well, I've been requesting that Australia send out a naval vessel to witness what's going on, and they've refused. And I know New Zealand's mentioned it, but they actually said yesterday they're not going to do it. What we have down here are 7 vessels of the whaling fleet, 2 Greenpeace ships, and a Sea Shepherd vessel. So all told, there's 11 vessels down here, and it's a high seas chase. We've already covered over 4,000 nautical miles from south of New Zealand all the way to almost to the south of
Now, how long do you expect that you can actually be out there? Do you have the option to refuel, or do you have enough to carry on?
Well, we're good for about 3 more weeks of fuel. And, you know, at some point we're going to have to refuel. The Japanese have the advantage. They just refueled. They sent a tanker down here to do it. But, you know, there's a lot of money to be made from killing whales, and there's not very much money available to save them. So we're at a serious disadvantage there.
So how do you see days ahead here? This sounds like it's just going to keep on going.
Yeah, we can do what we do for as long as we can do it with the resources we have. Right now, I'm also looking ahead to next year. We've got to come back here with a faster ship. I think we found the key to stopping them. If I can get a vessel that can keep up with the Nishan Maru, I pretty much can guarantee they won't kill any whales.
What do you need?
Just a fast ship.
We'll see what we can do. Anybody listening who happens to have a fast... How big a boat is, by the way, the Farley Moat?
We're about 48 meters. And it's a former Norwegian research vessel, so it's an undersea trawler design.
I hear you're in the process of thinking this may be time to, as you say, find something new.
Yeah, we got to get a faster vessel if we're going to be effective against this whaling fleet. This plan by the Japanese is a 17-year plan to kill whales and increase the number every year. Next year they want to take 50 humpbacks in addition to another 50 fin whales, and also probably up the number of pike whales or minke whales. So, you know, this is going to be a long-term campaign, and if we can get down here and stop them, I think we could probably put an end to it. I'm sure it's going to escalate. I'm sure the government of Japan probably might send down the police or whatever, and that's all fine with us. Let's make a big deal about it. Let's expose the fact that this is a blatantly illegal operation. You know, people call us pirates, but I don't really have a problem with that. If you go back to the 1600s to the Caribbean, it wasn't the British Navy that shut down piracy. They were too busy taking bribes. Piracy was shut down by Henry Morgan, who was a pirate. So sometimes you need pirates to stop pirates.
Paul, what drives you to do all this?
Well, you know, we're losing species on this planet at an incredible rate. And, you know, I'm a firm believer in the laws of ecology, the law of diversity, interdependence, and finite resources. And we're going to get to a point where we remove one too many species on this planet, and the whole ecosystem's going to collapse. And so really what we're doing is not just for whales, but also for people, for our own survival. The health of the oceans is very much a cornerstone to life surviving on land. And the oceans are dying, as Jacques Cousteau said just before he died. The oceans are dying in our time, and we've got to do everything we can to protect them. Every single commercial fishery seems to be in a state of collapse. Human greed is wiping out everything. And so we've got to put the brakes on this, and so that's why we're down here, to try and stop this. You know, the one thing that Sea Shepherd's unique in is that we're not a protest organization. We don't protest anything. We simply intervene against illegal activities, and we have the authority to do so by virtue of the United Nations World Charter for Nature that states very specifically that non-governmental organizations and individuals are empowered to uphold international conservation law. we're doing the job down here that governments like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, and others should be doing, but are not. If they were here, we wouldn't have to be here.
One can only hope that somehow we'll get to the point where this becomes the priority that it needs to be. In terms of the Japanese, one has to wonder why they continue to do this. Obviously, it's for the sushi bars, which is a shame all by itself that whales should be slaughtered in order to keep people happy in a sushi bar. Beyond that, what other uses are the Japanese putting the whales to? Why is this so important to them?
It's exclusively a meat market. That's really all it is, and the Japanese believe that, they have a right to do this. In addition to doing this, they're killing 20,000 dolphins every year, spearing and stabbing them to death on the beaches of Japan. I had two of my crew members went to jail for 3 weeks 2 years ago, including my wife, for diving into the bay and cutting the ropes to release the dolphins. And Japan just feels that everything in the ocean is there to be consumed. When they run out of fish and everything in their own waters, they scour the rest of the planet to take what they want.
How would you recommend that people help your organization or even take in their own action?
Well, people can get onto our website at seashepherd.org and get all that information. And we're establishing Sea Shepherd in Australia. We're opening up an office in Melbourne this month.
And then in terms of empowering people, how would you get someone to take their own actions? How should they be inspired by your actions?
Well, I think that everybody has a duty and a responsibility to make sure that we protect this planet for our children and our children's children, make this a better world for tomorrow. And so people should just be very cognizant of their own consumption, what they consume, and keep in mind where things come from. The fish that's taken out of the ocean, what are the ecological costs of removing that fish? If people were more aware of where things come from, I think that might be a step in the right direction.
Now, have you taken any actions against bottom dredgers?
In fact, 2 weeks ago while we were down here, we found a long line set by a Uruguayan vessel to catch Patagonia toothfish. We confiscated that line. Every year we confiscate hundreds of miles of long lines that we find in the ocean. Earlier in 2005, we set net rippers off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. These are devices that are meant to ensnare the bottom drag trawlers and rip their nets open. Last year, we also dove in and cut open the nets in the Galapagos National Park of tuna vessels that were fishing illegally in the national park and released, at one point, we released 10 tons of tuna. But so we've taken a very aggressive action against illegal fishermen over the last few years.
You really do take direct action. I'm just curious how often you've gotten to the point where you just kind of wonder if you're going to really make it through a particular moment. This sounds as if a lot of tensions could be manifest right in your face.
Yeah, we've been arrested a few times. Canada's arrested me for interfering with drag trawling operations, but we've gone to court and I was acquitted under the charges. I find it really strange that the governments are so concerned about defending illegal fishing operations. Ultimately, we're going to win in the court because we're acting, I think, rightfully in accordance to the UN Charter for Nature. That was my defense on that court case, and the jury agreed with me. But it seems that the government spent a lot of time protecting the interests of illegal operations, like illegal whaling and illegal fishing. There certainly is a lot of money involved, and that money is changing hands someplace.
Well, we're hearing a lot about illegal transfer of money right now in the United States, which is nothing new. It's just coming to the surface right now. You take many different forms of action. You have quite a wild, I mean that in a positive way, itinerary for moving around the planet. Where are you headed next? What are some of your plans for the 2006?
Well, we have a full-time patrol vessel in the Galapagos National Park. We're working in a partnership with the Galapagos National Park to protect the Marine Reserve. We've intercepted and arrested 56 poachers in the last few years. And we've opened an office in the Galapagos, so we're there on a permanent basis. We're also protecting and working with the rangers of Mapello Island National Park off of Colombia, Cocos Island National Park off of Costa Rica, and Fernando de Noronha National Park off of Brazil. And last year I was invited by the president of Senegal to come meet with him at Dakar to talk about what can be done about illegal fishing. And we'll be going up to Mozambique. We've been invited by the government of Mozambique to come up and try and stop pirate fishing operations in their waters. So we're actually now getting requests from governments for assistance in trying to deal with illegal fishing activity.
It sounds as if a lot of your work actually is in internationally or nationally dedicated preserves, and that you work to defend them. Are you finding that there really aren't defense mechanisms to defend those areas put up by national and international agencies?
There seems to be a lack of political will, and certainly a lack of money to go in and protect everything from World Heritage sites to national parks to sanctuaries. They all look good on paper, and they look fine on the map, but pretty much all of the world's sanctuaries and national parks are being exploited by poachers. And so it's become a crisis, really, because as fisheries collapse in other areas, they're moving into these sanctuaries where the fish have had refuge in order to get them there. There's simply not enough fish in the world's oceans to continue to feed the ever-expanding populations of humanity. That's the bottom line. And we're going to wipe them out if we continue to do what we're doing.
That is what's happening. That's what you're taking the stand to do, is to keep this entire system from collapsing. And in many respects, it is already in collapse quite massively in some areas. What's the future of whales now, from your perspective, in terms of trying to expand again even greater protection for species around the world?
Well, unless we stop this Japanese whaling fleet from doing what they're doing, they're going to increasingly increase the numbers they're taking, and so the future's not looking very good for the whales. And, you know, whales are different than most other species that we deal with. I mean, here we're dealing with one of the most intelligent, most socially complex creatures on the planet. These are, you know, not sardines. You know, the biggest brain that's ever been developed on any animal on the planet, including our own, is the cetacean brain. And, you know, where, for instance, to give you an idea, the human brain has a capacity of 1,300 cubic centimeters, but the sperm whale has 9,000 cubic centimeters, the orca 6,000 cubic centimeters, and these are big animals. But when you consider dinosaurs are big animals and have brains the size of walnuts, the fact is big brains mean something. And I think these animals are incapable of incredible communication abilities with each other. And that one day, I think through the use of computers, we might even be able to communicate with them. But instead, what we're doing is wiping them out.
What are you looking forward to today, and how do you actually spend your day?
Well, it's been one big car chase, really, except for using ships. But we've been chasing them for 4,000 miles, and we're continuing to chase them. As long as we have them on the run, they're not killing whales. And they'll stop probably in a day or so and start whaling again, and we'll catch up with them, and then they'll run again.
So, I mean, for example, are you actually in pursuit right now?
Yes, we are. We're right now heading along the coast of Antarctica. We're probably around 65 degrees longitude.
And do you actually see some of these vessels?
No, they're way ahead of us. You know, they're faster than we are. We have to catch up with them each time.
Now, how do you know how do you know where to go? How do you know where to find them?
Well, I can't really say, but I know exactly where the Nishan Maru is at any moment.
Fair enough. Okay. This is proprietary.
Yeah.
Paul Watson, I want to thank you for taking this time, calling us via satellite phone from the Farley Moat in the Antarctic regions in defense of the world's greatest creatures, the whales. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk soon again, and feel free, contact your people to contact me if there's ever a reason that I can help you and to bring updates on your mission.
Okay, well, thank you. I just want to add that this is one of the most beautiful places in the world. I mean, we're passing icebergs down here the size of cities. I think we must have passed 10,000 of them in the last 3 weeks.
You're posting a lot of information, a lot of actually photographs and videos, and there's an update. Why don't you give that website?
It's Sea Shepherd, SEASHEPHERD.org, seashepherd.org.
And what's the temperature like there out on the ocean?
Well, it's the summertime down here, so it's about...
That's true. That's true. I forgot about that.
The summertime in Antarctica is about 32 degrees on average. Mm-hmm. On New Year's Day, though, my crew all jumped in with bathing suits into the ocean, and it was 27 degrees.
Hey, that's not for me. I'm glad someone like you and your people can do that. Someday, hopefully, I'll be able to join you on your ship, and we'll do some in-depth.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, Paul. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
This saga is ongoing as we speak, and the clanging of ships' hulls may be a clarion call about the clashes that are likely to continue in this new year. You will always be informed by staying tuned in to your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Staying in touch with nature is a critical part of being human, truly human, in the 21st century. But with all the comforts afforded us, we just may find fewer and fewer reasons to keep seeking out nature directly, particularly during the winter months. And yet, there is such a special wonder of the winter landscape. When we return, we find out how to head out onto the trails and snow-laden pathways when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wildside News. Getting out and onto the trails of winter is both a wondrous opportunity to stay in touch with your earth and a special challenge to be sure it's done safely. And so, we explore the joys of winter hiking. Well, here we are in the first part of the year, January 12th, and I'm very fortunate in many respects in the sense that I'm in San Diego, but I haven't always lived here. I've lived in other places, including New Mexico and Washington State, and ultimately, originally Minnesota and Wisconsin. And that time of the year, it's a whole different world. It's winter. And right now joining us is a gentleman who is a very experienced hiker, Seth Levy, and he's working with the American Hiking Society. Seth, welcome to the Wildside News.
Sydney, thanks very much for having me this morning.
The American Hiking Society is involved with hiking in all the realms all across America. And as a matter of fact, we're going to be working with you to bring National Trails Day to life in June, and I'm looking forward to that. We've done this in the past. Tell us what it is that you bring to American Hiking Society.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned National Trails Day, actually, because this year will be our 30th National Trails Day, and we're really excited to work with you and to get all the people in their communities and their families excited about hiking. What I bring to American Hiking Society is a lifetime of passion for the sport and the lifestyle of hiking. My official title is Public Lands Fellow. I like to say I'm a public lands feller to my friends. But my area of responsibility is to encourage appropriate, low-impact recreational use on the Bureau of Land Management public lands here in America, primarily the brand new innovative 26-million-acre National Landscape Conservation System. So in a word, I encourage people to enjoy their public lands. They're yours, and they're there for your enjoyment as long as the use is responsible and low impact. The National Landscape Conservation System, and we think one of the reasons it has not reached a wider audience is because it's quite a mouthful to say. In fact, we had originally produced some baseball cards trading on the fact that it could be confused with the National League Championship Series. But it is a new system of public lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management, founded by a presidential and congressional delegation late in the year 2000. So this summer, this past summer, was its 5th anniversary, and it is the crown jewels of the Bureau of Land Management. It encompasses national scenic and historic trails, wild and scenic rivers, national conservation areas, wilderness study areas. I believe one outstanding natural area in there for variety. National monuments. The national monuments are the crown jewels of the Bureau of Land Management, NLCS, and it is an extremely unique, very poorly understood place. Our mission is to raise awareness of this new system of public lands, because as gorgeous and as unique and as wide-ranging as it is, and it certainly is all three, it comes under threat every day from lack of funding to protect natural, cultural, historic resources, lack of funding to provide for visitor safety and recreational resources, and the constant pressures of extractive industries like oil and natural gas development. These lands are here for us to enjoy, but only as long as we're willing to speak out to protect them. These systems of public lands are set aside for a lot of different reasons. They have some unique cultural, historic, and recreational possibilities. And I guess in addition to all those unique resources, they're gorgeous. I wouldn't say they've been set aside exclusively for visual enjoyment, although they are all certainly unparalleled in beauty. But that is one of the reasons they were set aside.
We'll take some time in the future here to go in depth about that, because America is blessed with some of the most extraordinary public lands.
We have so much land that literally belongs to us. It's the one thing I keep trying to help people understand is that one can kind of think it belongs to the government, but in reality, it's our land.
I emphasize that to everyone I talk to. If you are a taxpayer, you own your public land. The Bureau of Land Management manages 10% of America's surface area. That is a lot of land. The National Landscape Conservation System is 26 million acres of that 10% of America, and they do belong to each and every one of us. Those who are curious about the system, want to learn more about its unique special resources, curious about threats to the system's integrity, can go to discovernlcs.org, or they can contact the American Hiking Society for more information. The National Landscape Conservation System includes many different recreation, conservation, environmental, and advocacy groups. And in that respect, it's certainly unique. I sit down at the same table with representatives from American Rivers, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, the National Wildlife Federation, in addition to about 40 others. So it truly is a diverse group of voices that have kind of united around protecting the system's special public lands.
Well, with all that public lands, actually what I want to focus on today in the middle of winter is how people can actually go out onto trails on those public lands, because there's more trails in the national trail system, which is fairly extensive, than there are highway miles. It's hard to comprehend.
Yeah, it's incredible. We are truly blessed in this country with the amount of unique recreational opportunities, particularly hiking, that we can enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to tell my friends that winter is one of my favorite times to hike. A lot of people say at first, well, it's so cold, how can you go out for a walk? And I think the change in temperature is more than compensated by the fact that there are no bugs out there.
You got that one right.
You're never going to get a mosquito bite in the winter.
Let's talk about that, because there's many ways to head off onto a trail in winter. Why don't you give people an overview of some of the most obviously common ways to do that?
Well, people choose to enjoy trails in the winter in a variety of different ways. I think the most popular, simply because it's the simplest, is just by hiking in the winter. And, you know, you can hike without difficulty in quite a large volume of snow. I guess at the point at which the snow passes your mid-calf, it can become more difficult to lift your leg, or if the snow is wet or consolidated. And at that point, a lot of people choose to enjoy winter trails by either using snowshoes, which have gotten a lot better these days. They no longer force you to walk like a cowboy. You can walk relatively normally. Or by cross-country skiing. So I guess those are the three predominant patterns of use we see on winter trails: hiking, snowshoeing, and cross-country skiing.
First order of business really is to try to figure out where there are trails in your area. What are some ways to locate a trail that would be appropriate for... Now, we're really focusing on the snowy areas and the colder areas as opposed to other areas where you can just take a walk any time. But we're talking now about really winter and snow conditions. So kind of the northern tier states. And actually into the central zones and east as well. How can people find out where trails are that would be appropriate?
Well, I guess the best way to do that is to go to American Hiking Society's own website. And with over 200 alliance members, we have close relationships with trail organizations in almost every state. So you would go to American Hiking, that's one word, .org.
That's easy.
Yeah, it's simple as pie, and there's a search area in the upper left-hand corner of the screen. There's also a link called Trail Finder, so it's relatively easy. And one way folks might go about doing that is clicking on a picture of their state, and then clicking on a local hiking club that's close to them, and then contacting the hiking club directly.
Great way to go. Because it's good to actually have people you can talk with. Actually, learning about trail conditions and what you're really going to experience is often a really important part of heading out, particularly in the winter.
It is extremely important. I'd say it's a necessary first step. Folks can also feel free to call or email American Hiking Society. One of the perks of working there is a lot of time to hike. I often tell people I'm a professional hiker, and between our 10 staff members in Washington, D.C., I think we have most of the country, most of our hemisphere covered. But I would recommend that folks planning to take a hike in the winter, whether or not they're an experienced or a novice hiker, take a few minutes to sit down with someone that's hiked in the region before and familiar with the topography and special challenges of hiking that trail. It's certainly good to have surprises on the trail, but some surprises are best avoided, especially in cold weather.
Well, let's talk about that, because there are definitely serious considerations. I can recall a time when I was out with some friends and we were on a trail, and best laid plans, you know, sometimes go a little bit, get off track. And so we were actually cross-country skiing, and me and my buddy, he was with his fiance, and we started off, and we just kind of got ahead, and she just seemed to disappear. And we kind of, at some point, stopped to wait for her to catch up, and she just didn't. And so when we headed back, she was on the snow, and she seemed to be very happy to just be there. And she was actually heading into hypothermia.
Ooh.
And that can be obviously a very serious, one of the most serious things to consider in a winter situation. So not to belabor the dangerous aspects, nevertheless, it is something to consider. Why don't you, first of all, tell people about hypothermia and therefore how they have to really think about this process of heading out onto the trails.
Winter hiking, you know, if you prepare for it properly, shouldn't present any risks that you wouldn't commonly face in the woods any other time of year. And I guess to start way back at the beginning, before you even talk about scary things like hypothermia, you want to talk to someone that's hiked in the region before. You want to be familiar with local weather patterns, and you want to have a great map and a compass and know how to use them. And that's even before you set foot on the trail. So that's the legwork you got to do before you go out and decide to enjoy, you know, one of America's gorgeous winter trails. As you mentioned, hypothermia is a real risk. Surprisingly enough, most people that contract and suffer from hypothermia do so in moderate temperatures.
Exactly.
And that's because when it's about 40 degrees and raining, you think, oh, it's not that cold, I'll just bring a cotton t-shirt, and I'm just going to be gone for a few minutes, so I don't need to bring my map. And sooner or later, you get a little bit lost, you get a little bit too cold, and gradually you get so cold that you begin to get serious trouble. Most of the folks that head out in the winter realize as soon as they step out of the car that it's damn cold out there, and they need to prepare properly. But there are a few steps that hikers can take to prepare themselves for cold weather. And I guess to go about those, if it's okay, you might start with your feet. And I guess I would recommend to most people hiking in the winter to bring a solid and, you know, sometimes insulated hiking boot. Depending on how cold it gets, you might not need to bring a huge, heavy winter boot, because you can get quite hot quite rapidly when you walk. And continuing from your feet, I would recommend a pair of thick wool or synthetic socks. And that means the sweat that your feet produce, and they do produce a lot, almost a liter a day apiece, is whipped away instead of building up and giving you blisters. Now, for the rest of your body, the same thing that we recommend for summer hikers applies. That recommendation is that you dress in layers and that you avoid cotton. There is an old saying in the hiking community called cotton kills, or cotton is rotten. And that's not to disparage its use every day. I wear cotton t-shirts and jeans almost every day, but it's just not appropriate for hiking. The reason is it holds water, and then it releases it at the worst times. And those times are when you're stopped, and instead of cooling down gradually, you get cold real quick, and in the winter that can be dangerous. So what folks need to do is, next to their skin, put on what you call a base layer. And a base layer is kind of tight-fitting long underwear made out of a synthetic or woolen material. The old cotton waffle-cut long johns you wore in your childhood probably won't cut it. In fact, they might make you too cold too fast. Now, on top of that, we recommend folks put an insulating layer. And that can be almost anything from fleece to some of the newer soft shells to down, synthetic fill, nylon hiking pants, nylon shirt, depending on how cold it is. And if you don't expect precipitation, that should be enough almost right there. Obviously, put on a thick synthetic or wool hat, and slightly thinner synthetic or wool gloves, and have prepared, in the event of extreme weather, the third layer, which is a shell. And a shell usually repels water from the outside while allowing it to breathe freely from the inside. These fibers are called waterproof breathable coatings, and they have a lot of exciting trade names like Gore-Tex, Sympatex, Todtex, Epic. And while they cost a little bit more than plain coated nylon or the vinyl raincoat you might have grown up with, they're really worth it because they allow moisture to escape while keeping you dry from the outside. Usually, even if you start off in really cold weathers around 0 degrees, you get hot fairly rapidly. And dressing in layers allows you to shed layers so you don't build up a lot of sweat. And in the wintertime, sweat can be a dangerous thing because, as I mentioned before, if you get cool too fast, you could suffer from hypothermia.
Explain a little bit how a person should kind of moderate that through the process, because you're absolutely right. You have all these, you're prepared for 30 below zero or something like that. That's what you have on, you're wearing, you know, and then you start to exercise within those many layers, and very quickly, moisture and that heat starts to build up in there. How should they try to, you know, what's the process of really trying to bleed off a lot of that extra heat and moisture?
Well, even though your body might be telling you not to, I usually start off hike or run in cold weather dressed a little more skimpily than I would like. If you step outside and you're not moving at all and you're warm, you probably have too much clothing on. So the idea is you step out of your car or out of your shelter, and you should feel a little bit chilly, but you should have easily available layers to warm yourself up. And I like to get a fast start in cold weather. I'll walk fast, really vigorously for about 10 minutes, just until I start to warm up, and it is amazing. Even around 0 degrees, walking hard for 10 minutes in the snow, and you can start to sweat.
That's kind of a process of opening up, unzippering or unbuttoning to try to keep you in a comfortable zone.
It is a little bit awkward at first. Every time you stop, you'll get cold pretty fast.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So you walk hard, and then you might stop and have a sip from your thermos of hot cocoa. And while you're doing that, you might get a little chilled, so you'll toss on your coat again. You might be rooting around in your pocket to find some chocolate to eat or another great food to eat during winter hiking, and you might get a little chillier, so you put on your hat, and then you start again, and all of a sudden you're hot just as soon as you keep going, and you strip off those layers, and you're cool again.
Now, we're making a lot of this because it does matter, but quite honestly, it comes natural.
Yeah.
You're basically just trying to keep yourself comfortable. Not too hot, not too cold, and once you get the rhythm of that and you're on the trail, it all makes perfect sense. But it is important for people to understand these special conditions. And otherwise, in the summer, so you get really hot, you get hot. In the winter, unfortunately, there's this aspect of the freeze, and that's dangerous. Freeze and water and body, it's a dangerous combination. So let's talk about now what's unique about the process of heading out into the winter. What are you going to see that you may not see, for example, in the full spectrum of summer?
Well, there are a lot of species that that feel a little more comfortable foraging in the winter than they do in the summer. And what's particularly nice about hiking in the winter is you can see their tracks a little bit more easily. Depending on what part of the country you're in, you can see deers foraging for berries, you can see snowshoe hares, you can see all sorts of exciting prints. You probably won't see many birds, although you could see an owl. But in general, you will see a trail that you may have hiked many times before in an entirely new way. I'm sure everyone's familiar, or I certainly hope everyone's familiar with the unique kind of quiet you can experience the first morning in the woods after a great heavy snowfall. It is a silence that is, you know, nearly a spiritual experience to many people, and it's certainly beautiful. Everything's covered in snow. It's great.
And also the sun, the clarity of a clear day following a heavy snow, the blue and the white. The light on the snow is, as you say, it's a mystical experience.
Yeah, it's incredible. I greatly enjoy hiking in the winter.
Now, how about photography? I imagine that would be a really great way to enhance your experience.
Yeah, I enjoy taking pictures of ice and snow in the winter enormously. Although, a few things happen when you hike in the winter that can make photography difficult. One is that beautiful condensation that comes out of your mouth when you breathe can fog a camera lens. So it's important to hold your breath in the few minutes before you snap the shutter so you don't fog your lens. Also, it's important not to subject conventional film cameras to rapid changes in temperature or humidity. If you are hiking outside in cold weather and you come in quickly to your warm, humid car, what's going to happen is all that moisture trapped in the humid air of your car is going to condense on your camera, and that's not a good thing. So if you've gone for a long winter hike, you might seal your camera in a plastic bag and let it warm up before you expose it to the warm, humid air of your car or your home. Also, folks are going to find that batteries in their cameras don't do as well in cold temperature. So we might recommend one of the newer lithium batteries that have a greater tolerance to cold.
Now, you also talked about snowshoeing and the fact that the snowshoes, which used to be these clobby things that you, as you say, it made you look really goofy as you walked through the woods, there's a whole new format on these. Help people understand how they're different and how this really enhances the experience.
Snowshoeing is great, and I would mention that if folks go to our website, AmericanHiking.org, they can click on the link for Winter Trails, which is a partnership between us and the American Snow Sports Industry Association, to find out more about the joys of winter hiking, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing. But as you just mentioned, snowshoes used to be these huge, almost tennis racket-sized contraptions made out of bamboo and hide of some sort. In fact, I still have a pair in my home in Maine.
They're romantic.
Oh, they're great. They look great over the fire, but they certainly are awkward to walk with. New snowshoe manufacturers like Tubbs, Atlas, and Red Feather are making snowshoes out of lightweight metals like aluminum and vinyl cloth, and that makes snowshoes so small and so nimble, you can go running with them. In fact, I've even heard of people completing snowshoe marathons. But new technology like the smaller snowshoes, better fibers that allow your clothing to breathe more, and a pair of collapsible trekking poles like the kind made by Leike, makes snowshoeing a whole lot less awkward and a whole lot less stumbly than it used to be.
Typically a little more strenuous than just walking. If you're hiking, that's one thing, but if you're trying to cut a new path with snowshoes, you better expect not to be able to go terrifically far, because that's
hard.
A lot of work.
It is hard. Oftentimes, cuts down by about 30% the amount of distance you're used to covering in a day, and it is a lot more difficult.
The one thing about snowshoes is that it really entices you to go exploring off the beaten path. And that's where perhaps a GPS maps aren't going to necessarily help you straighten that out. But what's some advice if you do head off existing paths on your snowshoes?
Well, I think the concern you just brought up is a great one. Snowshoeing makes a lot of the magical winter world accessible really quickly. And the temptation to veer off designated trails can be good. I would caution people to obey local, state, and federal guidelines when they leave existing trails. But in the case that they do so, I can't highlight enough the importance of having a map, a compass, and yes, knowing how to use both of them. Contrary to popular belief, merely having a map and a compass in your backpack won't, as in themselves, keep you from getting lost. I harbored that mistaken belief for many years before I actually had to use them. Folks can get in touch with an orienteering group in their area. They can consult their local library or their local outfitter and take a few quick classes to learn how to use the map and compass, both of which are exceptionally useful. GPSs are great. They are, however, useless unless you don't know how to use a map and compass first. I like to tell people that, say I bought a GPS, I'm never getting lost again, to wait until they get lost and they look at it, and it will only tell them exactly where they are lost.
Cross-country skiing is a royal sport. It's really an amazing way to see the landscape. And there's a number of ways to do it. One is through existing cross-country ski trails that are pretty well laid out, and you'll see it's literally like highways. Mm-hmm. And then the other is to do the open country skiing. Discuss some of the aspects of both of those.
Cross-country skiing is, for me, one of the most graceful and at the same time difficult ways to enjoy trails in the winter. I mentioned before that when you hike in the winter, you can get hot very quickly after about 10 minutes of vigorous walking. When I cross-country ski, my aerobic output is at such a level that oftentimes I'll be wearing only a pair of tights and a synthetic t-shirt in temperatures down to negative 10 degrees. If you push it hard on cross-country skis, it is a fantastic workout. If you choose not to push it so hard, you'll find it graceful, a quiet, and an extraordinarily beautiful way to see winter trails. There are a lot of options for cross-country skiers out there. A trip to your local outfitter will help you untangle some of the different sorts of skis that are out there. I guess the broadest distinction between them are just regular cross-country skis that leave your heel free and let you cruise on relatively mellow landscapes. And then the newer Telemark or randonnée skis that have a binding that will allow you to fix your heel and actually carve turns on downhill trails if you choose to do so.
But be prepared.
Ooh, it can be dangerous, so I recommend before folks get involved in that, they take a few lessons.
One of the most enjoyable ways to start cross-country skiing is either on open lake skiing, which makes it really simple, and you can really cross along borders of lakes and it's perfectly flat. The others are simple trails, are up and down, because when you start getting into more strenuous challenges with up and down hills, you really have to know what you're doing, because you can get yourself literally in a tangle real fast.
I'll tell you, I took my girlfriend cross-country skiing for the first time in Maine several weekends ago, and we had an amusing experience of picking each other out of various snow heaps. It was great.
So we've covered the basics, hiking, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing. And for the adventuresome who really have some experience under their belt, and I don't recommend this for anyone on their own if they haven't really taken to this, and also it's really great, almost a requirement that you go out with somebody on these adventures. You don't always have to. If you're familiar with the area and your experience, take a walk. But now some people may decide that it's time to really start to snow adventure, and that is to do an overnight or more. I trust you've had the opportunity to do so.
I certainly have. Growing up in Maine was a great experience in that I got to go winter camping anytime I liked, occasionally in my backyard, but often ranging farther into New Hampshire and Vermont, some of the higher peaks there. And,
a couple ways to go. One is to bring your tent. The other is to make your own, carve out your igloo in the snow. Let's talk about the latter first, because that's actually a most amazing experience.
There are various techniques for constructing snow shelters. However, I wouldn't recommend them to most novices. The worst that'll probably happen is you can spend a couple hours building an elaborate structure that collapses when you before you get in. Worse than that, it could collapse after you get in. So I'd caution people who are interested in building snow shelters to find somebody in their area who is experienced and is willing to give them a personal lesson. There are a variety of unique snow shelters that people can construct. When folks go winter camping, it's often advisable to bring a snow shovel, and they're used by mountaineers as safety tools. They're relatively light, fairly collapsible, and have a stout, sharp blade that will allow you to sculpt blocks of snow to construct a shelter, or can allow you to get underneath a windblown snow structure and carve out a shelter. And this is useful, not only for fun, but it's useful in the case of emergencies. It is always advisable when folks head out for winter overnight camping expeditions that they have an alternative means of shelter available. I would hate to see anyone go out expecting to build themselves a nice igloo only to find the beautiful winter trail they've scouted to be scoured free of snow by the wind and have to curl up under a tree or something of that nature.
Talk about some of the winter tenting options.
Well, I guess a lot of the safety cautions we gave a few moments ago, to be aware of your surroundings at all times, to talk to someone that has experienced the trail before, to travel in groups, to bring a map, compass, know how to use them, to bring a lighter, to bring a means of illumination. All those apply, only more so when you choose to enjoy winter trail by stepping out for more than a night or so. If folks are going on a winter hike of any moderate distance, they should already be prepared with a shelter and a sleeping bag. Our membership manager often likes to say that even a day hike can turn into an unexpected night out, and having the necessary equipment means you won't be distressed by that. You can just enjoy your experience and come back the next day with a good adventure. So there are a lot of different winter shelter options as far as tents go. Most three-season tents have an interior sleeve of nylon mesh and thin regular nylon, and an outer sleeve of some sort of waterproof material. In moderate winter climates, let's say for those folks in southern Ohio or almost as far north as Washington D.C., these kinds of shelters are appropriate. If snowpack doesn't exceed, 1 or 2 feet, and temperatures are not particularly extreme. For folks in higher elevations with more extreme snowpack, those folks probably want to consider what is called a single-walled shelter. And these are tents that are made out of a single membrane of waterproof, breathable material that resists wind, rain, and snow on the outside and allows you to live comfortably on the inside and allows a lot of the moisture your body produces, and it does produce a lot just from breathing to escape, while at the same time keeping you warm and happy.
How about food? Probably pretty much similar to summer, but what other considerations are there?
You know, one of the reasons I enjoy winter hiking so much is that in cold weather you can bring a lot of food that it's just not possible to bring out in the summer. When I go backpacking in the summer, I enjoy a variety of pastas, canned salmon, soy protein, dehydrated vegetables. In the winter, if I like, if it's below zero, I can bring a whole steak. And that's kind of a unique experience that you really can't do safely in the summer.
Now that's an incentive.
Oh, it's great. You can bring a steak and various kinds of fish, potatoes, butters, a lot of things that would spoil rapidly in warmer weather.
The winter feasting.
Oh, it's a great time to feast. And a lot of folks, for good reason, feel the urge to consume more carbohydrates and fats in the winter. And I would tell folks to obey your body's craving at this point. Your diet needs to change a little bit when you're exerting yourself heavily in cold weather. You need to consume more carbohydrates because you're burning more calories, keeping yourself warm just standing still. Also, you need to consume more fat. Fat helps keep you warm, and if you consume good fats, like non-hydrogenated oils, olive oil, various fish oils, your body will stay warm and happy all through the winter.
That's an incredible introduction. Why don't you go ahead and invite people to take that first step and get out there for health and for spiritual enhancement?
Yeah, I mean, since 1976, American Hiking Society has been protecting, promoting, and fighting for our nation's valuable foot trails for that very reason. Hiking is an incredible way to get yourself healthy, get your family healthy, bring your community together. A lot of people feel very spiritual experiences when they connect with nature in that way. And that's why we at American Hiking Society exist. We exist to serve our nation's dedicated hikers and those folks who haven't yet taken the first step on our nation's beautiful public footpaths. Winter is a great time to go outside. Don't be dissuaded by the cold weather. You get warm quickly and you'll enjoy yourself very much. Anyone with more questions about winter hiking or hiking in general, and feel free to contact us at American Hiking Society at www.americanhiking.org.
Seth Levy, American Hiking Society, thanks so much for adding your voice to the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much for having me.
For those of you who do head out onto the winter trails, I'd love to hear from you about your thoughts and your experiences. Send them to me via email at wildsidenews@cox.net. We'll make them part of the voice of the earth here on the Wild Side News. So who cares about a freaking butterfly? We find out when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The Sand Mountain Dunes is a popular off-road vehicle site belonging to the BLM. Promoting recreation on public lands is a mandate of the department. But what happens when the fervor of the off-roaders begins to run over the rights of a wonderful little butterfly that has established its species on the edge of the dunescape? We find out when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. ...2006 is going to be a year when many people begin to take a stand in defense of nature. In many cases, people will feel there is no choice but to take a stand for the wonder. There are many ways to do so, from the bravery of a Captain Watson to the prayers of the children, and then there are those who endure the pains of public advocacy.
The story you are about to hear reflects just one of the many that is ongoing around the nation as people put their spirits between the rubber and the road.
Battles to preserve the wonders on this planet in many cases are unique, and in many cases they seem to recycle similar challenges. And in this particular case, we're going to be talking about just exactly that situation. Another battle between outdoor recreationists and a butterfly. And to help us understand what's happening is Karen Schombach, who is the California Director of PEER, which is the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Karen, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Now, you're joining us from Northern California, where you have your office. Just tell us a little bit how the weather is today.
Today it's raining. Kind of a nice, constant, gentle, warm rain.
Have you had enough rain in the last couple of weeks to keep you satisfied?
Well, in December, we had average an inch a day. So
wow.
quite a wet December, and January has been much the same. So yesterday was nice, and today it's raining. And that's sort of our winter routine, a day of rain, a day of sun. But this has been a little rainier than normal.
Well, listen, let's get on to the topic that you're very much involved in right now. And this has to do with the preservation of a butterfly. We've heard these stories before. Give us a background on the Sand Mountain blue butterfly and why this suddenly is in the news now.
This is actually an issue that I've been working on for about 2 years. Sand Mountain is a small dune system east of Reno, near Fallon, Nevada. And as most of those systems are, it's extremely beautiful. The dunes are surrounded by some vegetated areas, and it's those surrounding vegetated areas that are being contested by the off-roaders who are opposed to protection of the buckwheat, which is the host plant for the butterfly. There's about 1,000 acres, not sure the exact number, but there's quite an extensive, 1,000 acres or so for riding, which nobody is contesting. They're not going to really hurt much riding in the dunes themselves. But the surrounding area into which the use has been expanding over the years is extremely valuable habitat. Not only the buckwheat, which grows only there and is host to this butterfly, which only exists there, but there's actually a number of plants and animals that are unique to that little particular ecosystem. And so in preserving the vegetation, in particular the buckwheat, we would also be preserving a number of other unique plants and animals. The off-road community has been expanding their use there. There is actually a pretty impactful PowerPoint that BLM produced, which shows the expansion of the trails and the vegetated area over the years, and it's pretty shocking when you see expansion of use over the years. It's pretty shocking because this is a rare plant and a rare animal, or the butterfly's rare insect. BLM had proposed to go from an open riding area, meaning that people could pretty much go wherever they wanted, to a designated route system, which we support. Unfortunately, BLM insisted that this designated system be completely voluntary, meaning that if somebody didn't stay on the designated trails, there was no citation. They were just trying to get voluntary cooperation from the off-roaders. We had warned them. I wrote them a letter when they proposed this because I have some experience with that kind of management here in California, and it just failed abysmally at a place called Clear Creek. But nonetheless, that's what they decided to do. And so for the past 2 years, they've had this voluntary designated route system, and it's been just an abysmal failure, as we predicted. So the impacts to the buckwheat and the butterfly and the other unique species have continued. So now the BLM is proposing a designated route system that is not voluntary, and that's kind of the status of it right now. They are also coming up with a conservation plan in response to a petition to list a butterfly that was presented to Fish and Wildlife Service by Center for Biological Diversity and PIER and other groups. And in response to that petition to list, they're developing a so-called conservation plan, which I expect they will say means that they don't need to list the butterfly.
One of the challenges here is the fact that this particular butterfly only exists in that very specific spot. It isn't as if this is just one area in which the butterfly exists, but it is literally limited because it is totally dependent on that particular plant species. So as the plant species diminishes, so goes the butterfly. So this truly has to do with an issue of extinction.
It does. Now, the off-roaders have suggested that BLM grow the buckwheat and transplant it to other places. My philosophy, as a lot of other people, is that it's here, it's growing there, it's doing well when not being trampled by off-road vehicles. We need to preserve it where it exists. The likelihood of being, you know, successful in transplanting it, you know, that's very speculative. And the BLM's regulations require them to give deference to vegetation and wildlife over off-road vehicles, and that's what they need to do. There's plenty of places to ride, and even at Sand Mountain, there's a huge area of sand dunes where they can ride. You know, we're not opposed to some use on the edges of the vegetated area, but we don't want them riding right through the buckwheat and the butterfly habitat.
Now, is it the type of situation where the plant cannot exist in the open dunes? Of course, the sands shift on a regular basis, and that's one of the reasons it's difficult to declare a trail specifically on the dunes themselves. So around that area, the plant grows. Am I right so far?
Right. The riding would remain open in the dunes itself. Nobody's suggesting restricting riding in the dunes, but it's the area around the dunes where there is vegetation providing habitat for both the butterfly and other species, that we want a designated trail system that actually protects the vegetation and the animals in it.
So this would be the type of thing where there's a designated trailhead into the dune area, and all riders must abide by that?
The access to the dunes itself is already very easy. You know, there's parking lots right next to the dunes, so you can go from your car, you know, literally right into the dunes. To get to the vegetated area, you have to go through or around the dunes. Access to the dunes isn't an issue, but what's happening is people are going through the dunes into the surrounding vegetation, and that's where the damage is occurring.
It's just really carelessness and a total inconsideration and lack of concern for this issue. How are you trying to educate, obviously, within any sort of community of off-road vehicle riders and drivers, there are those who really do try to maintain responsible riding habits and take these things into consideration. Obviously, those people are probably trying to work with you.
Not really.
That's sad to hear. I'm trying to figure out how would you lead to some sort of resolution.
Well,
are you considering fencing, for example, or something like that? Or?
Well, you know, certainly we're in favor of education, but not as a substitute for management. And the problem here is that BLM, Bureau of Land Management, which is supposed to be managing the area, needs to step up to the plate and tell the off-road community, look, there are limits, and you're free to ride in the dunes, but you can't ride where you're going to do irreparable harm. They just have not been willing to do that, and in fact have excluded the environmental community from the most of the discussion. Despite our repeated request to be kept apprised of meetings, etc., they only communicate with the off-road community because for some reason they seem to fear them and their political clout. They haven't made an attempt to educate the users.
Well, if I can say so, that just doesn't seem reasonable. It seems as if there should always be an attempt to try to create some sort of compromise, and that just doesn't make sense.
Well, I agree. I agree, and I don't know if it's because, I don't know what it is, but they certainly have had lots of opportunity to work with the environmental community. We've certainly expressed, you know, our interest and our willingness to work with them, but we just get dead silence from BLM, and not interested in having our participation in this process, which is sad because, I mean, we are going to participate. Now, whether we do it, you know, in a collaborative way or if we have to resort to lawsuits, but, we, you know, we are going to participate in it. It's a shame that they don't do it in a more collaborative way.
In the past, in such situations, what are some models that have been utilized? If you start with education, how is that typically done?
You know, unfortunately, on this subject, education by both BLM and the Forest Service has not been very adequate. Even though the off-roaders, they say they would like to have education rather than enforcement, we really aren't getting either one. And a big part of the problem is the media, the commercials that show ATVs or dirt bikes or dune buggies, you know, ripping through habitat. That's the sort of thing that the off-roaders see, and so they get the impression that that's okay. And I really don't see BLM doing anything to counter that. Now, you asked about fencing. 2 years ago, when the designated route system was proposed, the off-road community, some of the clubs, said, because the incursions off of the designated routes has been well documented, and it's just incredibly flagrant. I mean, thousands and thousands of incursions. There's photo documentation of all of this. The off-roaders said that they would fence along some trails. And so there were three trails where they tried, they were allowed to put up fencing. And it was, you know, that orange kind of storm fencing. They put up that, they promised that they would install it and maintain it. Well, it's down. I mean, they did not maintain it. They did put it in, but they did not maintain it, and it just fell into disrepair, and it's finally, I mean, it's just all on the ground. So their willingness to, you know, take some responsibility for management themselves, you know, it just gets called into question.
Well, it sounds as if at least someone within that community made an effort. Whether or not it was successful or not is a whole other question, but at least they may have tried. But what I find so strange is the fact that the government seems to be so irresponsible in terms of not trying to formulate a strategy and a plan to deal with this. How long have you been working on trying to get the government involvement in this?
About 2 years. But the trouble is that their involvement is not it's not helping the situation. Their management really amounts to a lack of management and trying to, like, say they, you know, they wanted the off-road community to voluntarily stay out of the habitat, and that didn't work, and they've known that for 2 years. They should have taken action, you know, within 6 months when they saw that it wasn't working. And in those 2 years, there's been, you know, significant further degradation of the habitat. I don't so much blame the off-road community as I do BLM because BLM is the one that's supposed to be managing.
Now, at this point, you've actually filed a lawsuit. You filed a finding. The claim is that you have gotten no response.
We petitioned to have the butterfly listed on the under the Endangered Species Act, and we got no response to that. So we filed a 60-day notice saying we were going to sue if they didn't act on our petition. And this was U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who was supposed to respond to this. They didn't respond, and so we did file a lawsuit earlier this month asking them to act on our petition.
Typically, an organization will file a petition for a finding. A lot of research is put into these things, and they're presented for review, and the process is supposed to involve the government literally responding within so many days, I believe, and they just haven't responded. Well, that doesn't make any sense either. It seems to me that's a negligent on the part of those who have the requirement to respond.
It is, in a sense. On the other hand, the Bush administration has gutted Fish and Wildlife Service's budget so that they don't have the resources to respond to all the listing petitions they get. Typically now, the way they react is to just do nothing unless they're sued. And then they can go to their department head. The head of Fish and Wildlife Service can then say, look, we've been sued. There's a court order, assuming we win, and the court orders them to do something. Well, then they can get the funding to do it. This happens on a number of species. This administration doesn't like the Endangered Species Act. They don't want to see species listed. And, you know, rather than protect habitat to prevent the decline of species to the point where they need to be listed, their response is to just not fund the agency that does the listing.
Now, at this point, why don't we also give some websites and other information for people who may want to learn more about this and participate and follow the story?
Peer's website is peer, peer.org.
So it's www.peer.org.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I know that there's also a website, www.biologicaldiversity.org.
Right, that's what I was going to suggest. I think they have more on there.
Right, exactly. So if people want to find out more, now there'll be a link, obviously, on today's webpage for people to find out what's going on. So at this point, you now have filed a lawsuit, and what you're trying to do is get some attention, get some response. Let's say that the government, and likely the government will respond, and they will hopefully respond adequately and try to do what they should, which minimally means start a process of trying to get the off-roaders, helping the off-roaders to, and the environmental community all work together to really just keep people from going into these vegetated zones. That really shouldn't be a political issue. You know, it's not politics. you're talking about using these off-road vehicles to be driven in the dunes. It just seems as if there's a signage, educational programs where peer pressure within the community could result in something. Is that sort of what your initial hope may be?
One would hope so, but I don't expect that. As I said, there's a conservation plan that's being developed. We were told that we could not participate in the group that was developing that conservation plan because we're not in Nevada. They only wanted Nevada residents to participate. So that group includes some local business interests, the Shoshone Tribe, representative from Fish and Wildlife, representative from BLM, and ironically, two motorcycle clubs from California, which I just learned the other day. So California Off-Road Vehicle Association and a group in Placerville near me, which apparently they didn't mind off-road vehicle groups in California participating, but they objected to California environmental groups participating. I guess my point is that the plan that they're coming up with, they're going to try to sell as an alternative to listing. They're going to come up with this conservation plan, say we don't need to list because we have this conservation plan. But because that plan was developed without any environmental input, you know, in our opinion, seriously flawed, and won't be a substitute for listing. I don't believe that it, at least the draft that I've seen, does not offer the protection that's going to be necessary to keep the butterfly from extinction.
It sounds as if that seems to be the new strategy, at least by the Bush administration right now, and that is to actively pursue a course by which species will not be listed, and
yes.
Then apparently there will be some sort of conservation plan that's developed to mitigate the situation. I guess in some respects, on the surface, that seems reasonable. Will anything effectively really be done?
Well, I think if they wanted a real conservation plan, they would have included the conservation community. Conservation plan developed by off-roaders who have a different agenda. It seems to me from looking at it that protecting the butterfly is secondary to continuing off-road vehicle use.
I hate to say it, but there has been quite a legacy of strategies that reflect sort of a one-sided approach to these things and ignore oftentimes the other side. It's either this concept of you're with us or you're against us seems to permeate even beyond bigger issues into realms like this. And really, it shouldn't be, because this is our land. It belongs as much to you as it does to the off-road vehicle owners. And then even at a higher level, there's a lot of places, as you say, for people to go off-road, but when it comes to butterflies and a place for them to eat and live, this is the only grounds they have. I guess some people just don't see the value of these butterflies, but it isn't just a butterfly. It has to do with something much larger, which is the integrity of this wonder that is being destroyed. I think back and realize that over the last 100 years, what we've done to the planet in terms of the natural diversity is frightening.
What bothers me and frightens me is that I went to a field trip at the dunes a year or so ago, and there was a large crowd of off-roaders there as well. And I had hoped that we could work collaboratively for a solution. But there was a young girl in her 20-ish or so, who when BLM was explaining the issue and about the butterfly, yelled out, "Who cares about a freaking butterfly?" And I said, "Well, I do," and was sort of booed down by the crowd. And it's like when that generation, this is the ones that we have to look to in the future to protect these natural resources, when they're so far detached and have so little empathy with the natural world, it's frightening. To them, it's all about toys. And I know that there are, that certainly not the whole generation, but that anybody could be that, hold something that rare and beautiful in such callous disregard, I found that very distressing.
Well, when I was younger, I didn't have access to those kinds of vehicles, and so if you wanted to experience nature, you kind of had to walk in. In that process, it was a much slower pace, and you noticed a lot more. And in that process of seeing more and experiencing more, you began to really sense the extraordinary sensitivity and interactions that exist that make nature so profoundly powerful, and that's what fascinated me. Unfortunately, as the world keeps getting faster and faster, and as the sound bites become shorter and shorter, and the clips on TV become ever more shorter, and then the vehicles themselves become faster, there's a point reached where I think there's portions of that generation really have never had the chance to really take the time to experience what you're talking about.
Well, I think you're right. And I think also, as the country gets more urban, there's people whose only experience with wild places is on a vehicle.
The truth is there are people who probably within their lifetime will have never literally touched the earth. Living in an apartment and go down the stairs and hop in your car and drive on pavement to go to work and come back and literally never touch the earth.
Right. Well, there's that whole phenomenon of the website where people could use a joystick to actually kill animals.
Yes, right.
Did you hear about that?
Yes, yeah. The shooting from your recliner.
Yeah. And but somewhere an animal actually was shot as a result of that.
That's right.
So, to me, that speaks volumes about our lack of connection to the natural world.
How are you trying to reach out to the off-road vehicle community? If there's anything that I can do, I'm certainly happy to try. It just seems as if there would be a way to do this, although it may take time. But if the government isn't going to respond, then one has to appeal to the off-road community. And are they responsive at all to listening to your story?
Because I work with off-road vehicle issues a lot, I know a lot of off-roaders, and I've actually gone off-roading with some of them, and we do talk. The way I feel is that BLM is supposed to be managing the area, and when they exclude one stakeholder completely, or one group of stakeholders completely, they're not setting up a situation that makes communication even possible. The thing that needs to happen here is that BLM needs to get all the interested people in a room, or at least representative of all the different points of view in a room and come up with a plan that is responsive to all sides and not just one side. But, the off-road community feels no need to talk to us when they know that BLM doesn't want us at the table.
I guess that's where we are at this point. I don't really know what to say. I know that the current administration is fairly well committed to this stance, and we'll just have to persevere and carry on kind of one battle at a time.
Yeah, we're just sort of trying to hold the tide back at this point and hope for changes in leadership soon.
Karen Schumbach is the California Director of PEER, which is the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Again, let's talk about that website. It's www.peer.org. And you can also find out about this particular issue at www.biologicaldiversity.org. Karen Schumbach, thanks a lot for adding your voice, and I'm going to take a personal interest in this and see if there isn't some way that we can find a creative solution. But I also agree with you totally that the BLM is negligent here in carrying out their responsibility. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We can all expect to hear many more stories this year of the struggles that will increase as people take a stand for the Earth. You'll hear them all when your Voice of the Earth returns each week, and you can hear the call of the wild through the archives, which are ready for the listening. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again, when your Voice of the Earth sings out here on the Wild Side News.